Reports say the dead are believed to have included several foreigners, though details are sparse. Flip Reeves, NPR News.
President-elect Barack Obama plans to meet with his former opponent, Senator John McCain, next week in Chicago to talk about bipartisan cooperation in the new administration. Obama's spokeswoman, Stephanie Cutter, says Republican Senator Lindsey Graham and Democratic Representative Rahm Emanuel, Obama's incoming chief of staff, will also be there. Senator Hillary Clinton, Obama's former rival in the primaries, has emerged as a possible candidate for Secretary of State. The Associated Press reports Clinton met with Obama in Chicago yesterday. The Dow continues to lose ground. It is currently down at 338 points at 8,497. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting community health leaders who make a difference in America's neighborhoods, on the web at communityhealthleaders.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from RGP Productions, presenting a poetry reading by authors Carmen M. Percival and Michael Ledoux this Saturday at 7 p.m. at La Gourmandaise, 119 West Main in Urbana. Donations accepted. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Craft League of Champaign-Urbana, presenting their 26th annual Arts and Crafts Show and Sale on November 22nd and 23rd at the Urbana Civic Center. Open Saturday 10 to 5 and Sunday 10 to 4. More information at 367-9546.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. My name is Ron Yates. I'm the Dean of the College of Media at the University of Illinois. Our guest today is Joyce Hoffman, author of the new book, On Their Own, Women Journalists and the American Experience in Vietnam. You know, perhaps no event in recent history has had the impact on the United States as the war in Vietnam, which began in the early 1960s when President Kennedy sent in several thousand advisors and didn't end officially until April 30th, 1975, when the last Americans fled Saigon during a chaotic evacuation. Vietnam ripped the nation apart like no other event that I ever witnessed. The war in Iraq hasn't even come close to being the divisive event that Vietnam was. And those of us who worked in Vietnam as correspondents arrived with little more than our preconceptions. Many of us left with a lot more. Deeply personal emotional baggage, horrific memories of suffering and anguish we can't forget, and, as is always the case with war, a few fond recollections of people, places and events that we don't ever want to forget. Vietnam also changed some people forever. And that is, in a way, the essence of this book by Joyce Hoffman. In reading it, it helped me remember a lot of the events and people that I had already forgotten. And it would truly be a sad thing if the work that the women who are in this book was forgotten and not honored in some way. And even though I'm sure that most of them would say, heck, we were just doing our jobs, this book really brings their work into great perspective. Joyce, welcome to Focus 580.
Thank you, Ron. It's nice to be here.
Joyce, I know you've been asked this question probably a thousand times, but it's a question that has to be asked. So I wanted to ask you this. What motivated you to write this book?
I wanted to celebrate the work of women who I think, you talked about how the war changed many people. I think it also changed journalism. And women were the instruments of that change. And as I read histories of Vietnam again and again, I would ask myself, well, where are the women? I know there were women there. And yet, somehow they were invisible. I actually once went to probably 50 to 100 books about histories of Vietnam. And I looked in the indexes and counted the number of times that women were included in the indexes. And it was minimal. I don't remember the specific numbers any longer. But I just felt, even in history, some of the histories in which they were mentioned, it was done in a way that almost trivialized their work. Beverly Deep, for example, is a little-known correspondent in Vietnam, and yet she was there for 7 years, longer than many of the men who covered the war. And if you read Richard Tregaskis's Vietnam Diary, you will read about Beverly Deep. You will read about her as a correspondent of the more interesting sex, one who had something like the glamorous curves of the Western world. Well, that's not really what I was looking for when I was looking for women in the histories of Vietnam. So, in short, I just wanted to celebrate their stories. And I think more than anything else, I think that their stories were so wonderful. I've said a few times now that I think through much of my research, I always had this sort of vague image rattling around in my head, and it was always of the cyclorama at Gettysburg, you know, that vast circular painting of the Battle of Pickett's Charge. And I always loved it so much because the painter didn't sign it. Instead, he painted himself in as a viewer, sort of off in the distance. And I would think of the cyclorama, and I would think of the vast history of Vietnam as a cyclorama in a way. And yet, whoever painted that forgot to put the women in. And so that's what I wanted to do, put them in, the history.
Well, and what's interesting about this book is it, even though you focus on 15 women who covered the war, the book itself is a fascinating history of Vietnam itself. I mean, there is context and perspective here that anybody who is not really fully familiar with Vietnam, you pick up this book, by the time you finish it, you're going to have a very good idea of how we got involved in that war, what happened during the war, and how we got out of it. And we never really got out of it in an honorable way, in my mind, but we got out of it. I want to remind our listeners that you're invited to join the discussion by calling 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 from anywhere you can hear us on the radio or anywhere across North America that you might be listening on the Internet. And, you know, and before we get too deep into our conversation with Joyce, and because I teach a class in international reporting and a lot of that class has to do with history, I'd like to provide some background here because I think it's critical that we provide context for all of this. And just a little personal background first. I came to the University of Illinois after about 25 years with the Chicago Tribune, and about 18 of those years I worked as a foreign correspondent in Asia and Latin America, and where I covered various wars and revolutions and other forms of human mayhem, including the Vietnam War and the fall of Saigon and Phnom Penh between 74 and 75. But today, as dean of the College of Media and as a professor of journalism, which actually you are too, right, Joyce?
You're
a professor.
Yes, I am. Yes.
I teach a class in international reporting, and it's a class that not only looks at the job of the foreign correspondent today, but the history of this really fascinating of careers. And as I do in my class, I'd like to provide our listeners with a little historical background about this job and how women have come to be part of it. And you really have to go back to the middle of the 19th century, and where you have civilian war correspondents are a relatively new part of the history of journalism. In fact, the first, actually, depending upon your geographic home, whether you were from England or from the United States, was either William Howard Russell of the London Times, who covered the Crimean War in 1854, or George Wilkins Kendall, the founder of the New Orleans Picayune, who covered the Mexican-American War of 1846. Before those two journalists, most wars were covered, and I put that in quotation marks, by educated military officers, and often the only people on a battlefield who could read or write. So as you might imagine, the way war was covered and written about was far from balanced. If anything, wars were glorified, as were the generals who commanded and waged them, and little was written about the impact warfare had on those on the battlefield or the civilian populations that were often annihilated or the innocents who were impacted in some way. Stories tended to focus on displays of military brilliance as though the battlefield were some vast chessboard and the human beings were nothing more than pieces that generals ordered from one spot to another. And women didn't really begin to enter this core of foreign correspondents who actually in those days were nothing more than war correspondents until, I think, effectively till the late 19th century, though there might have been a few in the mid-19th century. And even then, it was only fleetingly or begrudgingly. And, perhaps the first of these was a woman named Elizabeth Cochran, who was also known as Nellie Bly, who Joseph Pulitzer sent around the world to see if she could get around the world in 80 days, as was the case in the Jules Verne novel, Around the World in 80 Days. And when Nellie Bly, she's really largely remembered as a stunt journalist, but she's actually one of the first reporters, male or female, to do investigative reporting. And she had herself admitted to a New York insane asylum for women in order to document the brutal treatment of inmates, and the people in the asylum didn't know she was a journalist, so she risked her life to get some pretty incredible stories. Then you go a bit forward a little bit, and that's the first American woman to actually cover combat as an accredited correspondent was probably Peggy Hull, who went to France in 1917 during World War I to cover the American Doughboys, and she wrote human interest stories for the Chicago Tribune and the El Paso Times about the men in the trenches detailing their lives, their hopes, their fears. And in that respect, she may have preceded World War II's Ernie Pyle as someone who wrote about the grunts and the foxholes. And Peggy's male counterparts eventually threw a fit. And finally, General Black Jack Pershing ordered her to Paris, where she covered the war in the safety of the City of Light. So a few women got into the act in World War II, but only a few, and among them, you know, people like Dickie Chappelle, who would eventually die in Vietnam in 1965 when a Marine sergeant she was following tripped an anti-personnel mine. And, of course, Peggy Hull, who was in her 60s at the time, and other women such as Claire Hollingworth, a woman I knew very well, a British woman who worked for several British publications, Martha Gellhorn, of course, Sigrid Schultz, Margaret Bourke White. They made their marks during World War II, and some went on to cover the Korean War. But it really wasn't until Vietnam between 1960 and 75 that women covered any American war in force, and even then, the beginnings were tentative. But during the course of the Vietnam War, and I think you point this out in your book, Joyce, more than 300 women eventually arrived in country to cover the war. And until now, the lives of many of these women and their contributions to the world of war correspondence was really largely unknown. And that's why I think this book is so fascinating, that you're finally, this is finally correcting that slight. And I think it's just a great thing that you've done. It's a wonderful book. Anybody who wants to know anything about what happened in Vietnam should pick this up and take a look at it. It's fascinating. Do you think, Joyce, that women cover wars differently than their male counterparts? I mean, do women see things men don't see, feel things men don't feel in this situation?
No, I don't think there is anything that distinguishes the work that women do overall. If you look collectively at the work of these 15 women about whom I write, I think their work is as diverse as that of the men who covered the war. It's impossible to identify any specific category of reporting that belongs exclusively to women. I think what's interesting is that the only point I could say on which the group of women about whom I write converge is that they were all either indifferent or hostile to feminism. No one embraced it. A few dismissed it as rather irrelevant to their lives, and a few of them denounced it as for its over preoccupation with who's on top, as one woman rather indelicately put it. That's what's curious about it all. And of course, the reason I think the question of a specific gender style comes up is that before Vietnam, women were so prohibited from anything close to battle that women were assigned very specific kinds of stories. Dickie Chappelle, for example, as a photographer, was on board hospital ships, and she was supposed to photograph the use of blood supplies so that it would encourage, they could be used in America and would encourage people to donate blood. The images of how it was used and how much good it did. That kind of fell apart in Europe at the end of World War II, when everything was kind of chaotic and reporters were going kind of everywhere they wanted and were not so firmly attached to some of the military units as they had been during the war. But women actually weren't even allowed at the press briefings during World War II because they all had to do with battle, and women were prohibited from being anywhere near the battlefield.
Amazing.
And even in Korea, Marguerite Higgins, of course, covered Korea, and she was quite celebrated for that. But she was about the only one. And so in many cases, the women who covered wars prior to Vietnam were novelties. And even in World War II, those reporters and photographers who were quite successful, only a few of them really survived in the kinds of jobs that they had done during the war, because at the end of World War II, of course, there was this massive return to home and hearth by all the Rosie the Riveters who had kept the industrial machine running while their husbands were off fighting. And so you had really in the late 50s and early 60s women kind of reinventing themselves as war correspondents for the first time.
Right. No, obviously, World War II was a huge had a huge impact on the way women not only saw themselves but the kinds of things that they did, in their lives.
And what's so fascinating, Ron, is that it was a time of transformation, and yet it was never sustained. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was, as one sociologist put it, the early 50s were, pardon me, a time of massive inequality between the sexes. If you were a woman in the aftermath of World War II and you entertained any notions about working, you were an aberration. I mean, what was wrong with you? Why didn't you want to go home and have kids?
Yeah.
It was just remarkable from our perspective. And someone wrote to me not long ago and said something like her students, it would never occur to her students that women wouldn't or shouldn't be in the line of fire.
Mm, all right. No, I know exactly what you're talking about. And I thought your point about these women who were there in Vietnam and their thoughts about feminism, that's really interesting because that's exactly the feeling I got when I would see people like Liz Trotta running around. You know, this was, you know, what's that all about? You know,
indeed, I think, Ron, that the who's on top comment came from Liz. As you might.
Right. This is Ron Yates. I'm Dean of the College of Media, and I want to remind our listeners that once again you're invited to join the discussion by calling 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 from anywhere you can hear us on the radio or anywhere across North America that you might be listening on the Internet. Joyce, were you working as a journalist during the Vietnam War, and what were you doing, and did you want to go to Vietnam at that time in your life?
Yes, I did. I entertained the notion, but I didn't quite know how to do it. I was not a journalist at the time. I had just graduated from college, and I thought about going to Vietnam. I thought about maybe trying to get a job with AID, and I went to Europe instead and lived there, as so many young people do when they get out of college. And I suppose that the lingering memory of having wanted to go perhaps has drawn me back to do this history of the war. But no, my career in journalism didn't begin until actually the early 1970s. And by then, actually here in the States, the war seemed, although it wasn't over, and I don't mean to suggest it was, but the prevailing sense was that the war was over. I mean, I remember thinking about going to Vietnam in 68, I mean, the Tet Offensive and that period of the war. So by 71, 72, when I had first started my career as a journalist, the thought was no longer there.
It sounds like we started around the same time, because I joined the Tribune around 1970, after right out of college, and I was in school when Tet happened in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have a caller on the cell phone. You want to join us in the discussion?
Hi, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
Doing good. I have been listening along. This is actually very fascinating. One of the things that we keep hearing about with correspondency in wartime is that it somewhat sets the tone of the conflict. What we hear and what we get an opportunity to examine as the public is determined by the media. I really like the fact that you brought the idea that there might be a different perspective about the person, and had a little conversation about that. That was really interesting. My comment actually is about this, is that right now we really don't hear a lot about what goes on day to day. There seems like there's a really removed human factor that's not there. And I'd like to actually see if the question could be answered two different ways. I mean, certainly I value your perspective, but definitely with the guest too, is what's going on right now and who's telling the story, and then also if we can overlap with female correspondents in the field right now. I like the idea that we can compare and contrast what's happened to what's going on, who's doing it, and what their own identity brings to that situation. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Joyce, want to tackle that one?
Where do I start? I don't... I agree with you that certainly the press shapes our ideas about the war. I think in Iraq, part of the problem has been, although it's eased somewhat now, it was so incredibly dangerous to go out and do firsthand reporting, and I think that in some ways limited what was happening. I think the government's refusal to release casualty figures of civilians in Iraq certainly thwarts any effort to get a clear view of what's going on there on the ground and how this war is affecting the civilian population. What else did he ask? There were so many questions there. And I have not had a chance to speak to women who are in Iraq now. What I think is pretty remarkable is that on any given day, if you pick up the paper, I recall picking up the Washington Post a few weeks ago, and there were, I think, six bylines on the page, three of which were women, and mm-hmm. that's highly unusual. And that is the same, I think, the same ratio that you often see, or close to it, that you often see in the coverage of the war.
Well, you know, there are a couple of things and, that I can respond to very quickly here, and that is in Vietnam, first of all, there was no embedding. In Vietnam, you went anywhere you wanted to go at any time. You just went out to find somebody. You went out to Tonsonut, got on a chopper, and you, where are you guys headed? Well, we're going down to Quan Tri. We're going to go here. We're going to go there. And you just jumped on the chopper and went with them. And you never knew when you were going to get back. That's the way the war was done. Of course, in Iraq now, you're embedded. You are with one unit. And so women who are covering the war are doing so from the perspective of one unit only, and they become part of that unit in many ways. The other part of this is something that Joyce alluded to earlier, and that is that journalists in Iraq and even Afghanistan have been targeted. And that was not necessarily the case in Vietnam. Now, I will say this. The Khmer Rouge, and I spent time in Cambodia, they did kill correspondents. If they caught you, they just killed you, period. That's just the way it was. The Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese wouldn't do that. In fact, there were several cases where some of these women, I think, were actually captured and turned loose, Kate Webb being one of them. Mm-hmm. But it's a different ball game, and not to say that Vietnam was not dangerous. It was horribly dangerous, incredibly dangerous, but it was a different kind of a war.
And I think what you're pointing out right now is that the very nature of the war allowed women to make their mark. They were able, because the accreditation rules were so easy, mm-hmm. You needed a letter from a couple of publications that attested to the fact that they would consider your work for publication. And, I mean, those could be as obscure as you could imagine. And on that basis alone, women could be accredited and, just like you, go out to Tonsonut and get on a helicopter and do whatever they wanted. I guess I'd like to make one comment about the embedding. I think you're right. Certainly the people who are embedded have a very circumscribed view of the war from the perspective of only one unit. And I think, too, and early on, I suspect that this was perhaps more pronounced, but because the military, for the most part, I think, are incredibly courageous and disciplined and hardworking individuals, there was an inevitable admiration that any embedded reporter would develop for them, especially in view of the fact that you are dependent on these young men for your survival. And so that had to have colored, it seems to me, some of the reports from embedded journalists. And not that that's necessarily in a bad way, but I think that one was perhaps less inclined to look for the problems and the negatives in that situation. And in Vietnam, and of course for women in Vietnam, they were in such short supply in many instances, although there were 300 to 400 women accredited. Mm-hmm. But that number includes secretaries, spouses, right, et cetera, some very diligent graduate students, thank goodness we have them, do this kind of work, have poured through the accreditation files and established that about 72 women actually reported on radio, print journalism, television, et cetera. Mm. And so at any given time of the war, if they were the ones out at Tonsonut, Ron, if you were standing alongside one of those women, that woman would probably get on the plane before, on the helicopter before you did, if there was only one seat, because they were such a novelty. And so that gave mm-hmm. them access and in ways that they had never had before.
Right. Let's take another call. We have a caller from North Aurora. You're on the Focus 580.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, you know, how come there's so much bias reporting in Iraq War? I think that, you know, I have friends of mine who came back from there and said it's just outright, a lot of it is not being reported. There's a good and a bad side, and it seems like it's all bad. I mean, I understand that, too. And my viewpoint is not all wars are going to be, you know, wars in general are bad, but still at the same time, they're never reporting anything good about what our guys are doing, and they're kind of miffed, to be honest with you. I mean, most of the people I talk to that are military that have been over there are very disappointing in our reporting, how one-sided it is.
Hmm. Well, I hear that a lot, and I've actually done some research in that area. And I can tell you, there's bad news coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan when things bad happen that gets reported. But, you know, there are very positive stories coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan. They may not be as prevalent, or perhaps people don't see them as often, but they are there. And I don't think it's just a case of, okay, the journalists are going to say everything's bad. You know, that hasn't been the case. Even in Vietnam, you know, and people are often accusing the press of having lost the war in Vietnam, which is an absolute absurd thing to say, because the press didn't lose the war in Vietnam, not at all. And almost all the military people who you talk to today say that's just ridiculous. It's in the eye of the beholder. It's the perception, I think, that really takes hold. And you have to understand, if you want to make sure that the war is being covered without this kind of bias that you're talking about, you'd have to do an exhaustive kind of a research or a study or a content study of a lot of newspapers and, you know, watch television and radio to get that.
I did that. And the other thing is, too, I personally didn't believe it either, but I did do that. The other thing is, too, that I really worry about, not so much the bias, because I think most people know what's going on. I think it's the information that comes out that might be helpful to our enemy combatants.
Well, you know, that's a good point, because let me tell you, there's something, that's a very good point, and I'm going to say...
I'll get off and listen. Thank you, guys.
Okay, that's fine. And let me address that really quickly, and I want to turn it over to Joyce. The thing is, and I was in the military, and I was in military intelligence, and, you know, you've got a situation where you have the military, you want to say as little about anything as possible, and you've got a press that wants to know as much about anything as possible. So those two things are diametrically opposed. And the problem right now, I think, with Vietnam, or not Vietnam, I'm sorry, with Iraq and Afghanistan, is that even good news can be harmful to an operation. If you're saying, well, there was this great victory, we did this, we did that, maybe that's not something that the military wants out, because it's and today especially, where information is so readily available to everybody almost instantly, whatever you do, for example, you know, you had Geraldo Rivera drawing a line in the sand in Iraq or in Afghanistan and essentially drawing a map explaining where they were, that can be deadly, you know. So you've got to be very careful. And I think that the information is being tightly controlled today for that reason. But let me turn this over to Joyce. What do you think, Joyce?
Well, I think that because of the relative calm that has taken over in Iraq, the story is now a much more political story than it is a military story. And, you know, I think that in my view, that has been covered fairly well, and it has been covered as a considerable success. I mean, the success of the surge is underscored again and again, it seems to me, in some of the reports. Certainly, the political scene is problematic because there is, you know, an apparent inability to come to an agreement between the three major factions. But as far as Afghanistan is concerned, it seems to me that at the outset, at least, it was a success. But because of the Iraq War, our needs there, our military needs there, have been neglected, and now that's spinning out of control. And I don't know how you make that good news. I'm not sure it is good news in any way. You know, are individual soldiers performing well and doing wonderful things for the various factions in the communities? I have no doubt about it. I mean, I live in a military town. I live in Norfolk, Virginia. And, I mean, the newspaper in my town is always looking for the sort of good news stories about the military. But I don't know how you can spin Afghanistan into a good news story at this point, at least in the context of the war.
We have another caller from Urbana. Hello, you're on Focus 580.
Yes, please. At the beginning of the program, you said something in regard to leaving Vietnam with honor, and that we hadn't. And this is the sort of thing that's often brought up in regard to Iraq, that we must leave with honor. And I wish you'd define what leaving with honor in either case would mean.
Well, I guess what I mean by that is, maybe that's not the right word to use. I think leaving the place so that it's not going to be in a shambles. We left Vietnam. I was there. I was on the choppers on the last day. And I can tell you it was absolute chaos. And it's a wonder that thousands of people weren't killed on that last day. The fact is we left Vietnam. We left thousands and thousands and thousands of people in the lurch. And they were eventually put into re-education camps, and probably close to 200,000 or 150,000 were killed or died in these camps. That's what I mean. I think it's a horrible thing to do, to go into a country and put people in harm's way and then decide, well, we're leaving, see you later, make the best of it.
And I think, Ron, if I could interrupt, It didn't have to be that way.
No, it didn't.
You know, it could have been organized well in advance. I mean, it was Ellsworth Bunkers, or Graham Martin's intransigence in planning for a withdrawal.
Right.
That led to so much of that fiasco.
It seems to me that perhaps the most dishonorable thing of all that we did was Nixon's intrusion into Cambodia, which ultimately led to the takeover of the Khmer Rouge.
That, I think, is a great stain on our history.
Right.
What we did to Cambodia is it's deplorable.
In a case like Iraq, where we initiated the war under completely false pretenses, where there seemingly was absolutely no reason to use military force. Is there any way to leave with honor?
Ron, I'm going to let you do that one.
Well, I think what Joyce was alluding to earlier, I think the story now is quite political in Iraq, and I think what you have to do is make sure that the infrastructure of a governmental system is in place, that people are somehow involved in the governmental in the political process in Iraq, and that when you do leave, you're not leaving several different tribes or sects or different religious groups battling one another for control of the country. And I think, at some point, of course, when you do leave, anything can happen in a country. You can't be responsible for everything that happens after you leave. But I think you've got to leave it in a situation where you're not going to have that happen immediately. And I think the same thing is going to apply to Afghanistan, because you still have the Taliban, who are very active. And I spent time in Afghanistan working there as a correspondent. And I can tell you that's a terrible place to have to fight a war. Just trying to find and track down Osama bin Laden gives you an idea of what that part of the world is like along the Pakistan-Afghan border.
Well, there have been invaders for the past several thousand years who probably would agree with you.
Yes, absolutely.
One thing that really bothers me about Iraq right now is the status of forces agreement, where we seem to be trying to browbeat the Iraqis into surrendering their oil fields to our people. Mm. I don't see how this can ever be honorable.
Well, and I don't think that we can force that kind of thing. I mean, essentially, we're trying to impose our form of government on a people that may or may not want it, and we're trying to impose our value system and a configuration that would best suit our needs in one way or another. And I think if we continue in that vein, that I don't think whatever we set up and then in advance of leaving can ever be sustained.
I want to thank the caller.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for that. Those questions were very good. I'd like to move the conversation back to Vietnam if I could, because I think that's the thrust of what we're talking about here today. And and Joyce, for most Americans today, Vietnam is almost a distant memory, if not ancient history. And when I talk about it in the classroom, they do view it as an ancient history, my students. But for those who covered it, Vietnam seems as close as yesterday. And is that the sense you got from talking to the women correspondents you interviewed for your book? Do they just see this as something that just happened around the corner?
Well, yes, it's still so much a part of their lives. And I think that you're an example of that in a way that, I mean, this for one thing, it was their youth. It was probably some of the most glorious time of times that they had, or at least the most exciting and the kind of situation that demanded extraordinary courage and probably for many of you, all of you, the women and the men, there's maybe never been another time quite like it since then. But I think they all have maintained a very strong interest in the country, and a number of them go back from time to time. Some of them quite deliberately have never gone back because they find it too painful. There are others who go back for the anniversaries, and mm-hmm. others won't go back on those occasions because there's a sense of revelry that they feel is inappropriate for their memories of Vietnam. But yeah, I've lived Vietnam for the last 10 years in writing this book, so that it does seem much, much closer than it certainly seems to our students.
Right. You know, in the epilogue of your book, the L.A. Times book critic Richard, Ader, is quoted as asking in 1986, will the Vietnam War be the first war recorded better by women than by men? How would you answer that question?
Wasn't that a fortuitous quote that I found?
very good one.
I felt so successful when I came upon that. I think, as I wrote, I think that it would any claim that women covered the war better than men would not stand up to scrutiny, because I think so many people did such an extraordinary job. Are there women whose works are must-reads for anyone who wants to understand the Vietnam War? Well, if I had to come up with a list of five books that one had to read to understand the war, certainly Frankie Fitzgerald's book would be on that list, and perhaps even Gloria Emerson. So there we have at least two out of five.
Mm-hmm.
And if that kind of account means anything, I think that certainly they covered the war as well as. And in some ways, their vision was different, and we have benefited from that rather different vision. I mean, Frankie Fitzgerald went over and didn't think the story was on the battlefield at all. And at the time, and this was 1956, became absorbed with the culture, and nobody thought about Vietnamese culture at that time. It was, well, they all want to be like us, don't we?
Right.
I mean, why not? We're just going to, you know, export democracy, and they all want to be like Americans. Well, you know, Fitzgerald saw this deep, rich culture and concluded ultimately that we could not win this war because we were so diametrically different. And if we didn't understand their values, their cultural values, there was no hope
right.
for victory in Vietnam.
No, I that's a good point. I think that people who went to Vietnam from the military, even some of the journalists early on, just didn't respect Vietnamese history or culture, or certainly didn't know it at all.
They weren't even conscious of it,
no.
I think. It was less than disrespect. I mean, it wasn't even disrespect. It was just total ignorance of it and a sense that how could it have even been important?
Right. We have another caller on from Champaign. Hello, you're on Focus 580.
Hi there. I was actually calling in response to the caller a couple calls ago, but it kind of applies more broadly, I guess, to the Vietnam War as well.
Mm-hmm.
He was referring to sort of perceived bias in the current Iraq War, but it seems to me maybe that it's not so much a political bias as just sort of kind of a reflection of the way news reportage happens in general. I mean, if you're in any major metropolitan city, you know, the whole line of if it bleeds, it leads. You know, they talk about, you know, they don't talk about, say, you know, crisis nursery raised $40,000. They talk about the stabbing or the shooting or the big fire that just happened. So it seems to me maybe it's not so much to do with reporters on the ground, but maybe producers back home that, you know, the reporting events, and maybe that's why, you know, a car bombing will get reported over here, but, you know, restoring electricity to a school or a hospital doesn't. I just wondered what your thoughts on that were.
But I think because America was there militarily, the press corps, which grew exponentially when the Marines landed in Da Nang in the spring of 1965, that they saw, they were there to cover American boys, and American boys were fighting the war.
Mm-hmm.
And ergo, the story is the war. And I'm not sure that they just wanted the shoot 'em up, but the other issue was that the politics of South Vietnam were so convoluted and difficult to understand that it was very difficult to tell that story, particularly on television.
Yeah, I think, you know, Tad Bartimus, who's a and thank you, caller, for your call. Tad Bartimus, who is one of the women you write about in your book, once wrote the following in a book called War Torn, and I actually interviewed her and several other of the women who wrote that book back in 2002, I guess, which was a compendium of many biographies about the women who and their lives, people who covered the war in Vietnam, told by themselves, you know, from their own perspective. But Bartimus, who worked from AP Saigon and Phnom Penh offices, I think, between 73 and 74, she wrote this passage that I'd like to get your comments on, Joyce. This is really, I thought, telling kind of a statement. It says, "What I miss most about Vietnam is knowing the rules. In country, I had a clear understanding of what I could or could not do. I learned fast that love, honor, and friendship were all that mattered. I lived in the moment because it was all I had. I almost never worried about dying, though I was constantly terrified of snakes. Life was verbs: eat, sleep, hurt, hold, love, work, surrender, leave. Now I live in, but not of, a world that overwhelms me. I often turn away from its complexity, its speed and surfeit of information. Because I learned in Vietnam that the worth of a life isn't measured in money, power, possessions, or status, I am out of step with most of the people around me. I distrust authority. I am not a team player or a go-along-to-get-along gal." What do you think about that?
That's an amazing confession. I wonder, though, I wonder how, of course, she's writing that in 2000, 2001. The book was published in 2002.
Right.
But I think certainly the experience shapes one. I think the fact that she was a woman had perhaps something to do with that. I mean, she writes, I think, in that same chapter that she was always conscious of her gender, and that, like so many women, if she couldn't do something, she failed at something, it would be because she was a woman. It was always that reality for women, who, especially for those who were covering combat. And so there was a real consciousness that you better not mess up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a great burden that many women carried. And so they just cherished so much their friendships with other women. And Tad was there rather late in the war. I don't mean,
right.
I mean in the 70s as mm-hmm. opposed to the mid to late 60s. And she and I think someone you knew, Laura Palmer, who also was on one of the last helicopters out,
right.
Really had this incredible friendship, really drawn together by their gender, because there was a certain comfort in the shared trials that they had in that environment.
We have another caller from Urbana. Hello, you're on Focus 580.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Hi.
I picked up on a book a while back called War Surgery in Iraq and Afghanistan, a series of cases 2003 to 2007, published by the Borden Institute for the Army, and it was held up for about 6 months because of the extremely gory detail in that book. But if people want to see what war or the results of combat is like, I suggest they look at that. And as for your comments about Vietnam, I was in a recon unit along the Cambodian border about 38 years ago. Mm. But I don't know. It's difficult. I just wanted to say that. But I suggest people look at that book. It's about 600 pages and mostly surgical comments. Mm-hmm. And you'll see exactly what happens to people.
Yeah, and nothing has changed. I mean,
it's not going to change.
Nothing at all. And,
no, I'm saying that.
Right.
It's ugly.
Terrible.
War is ugly.
It's worse than ugly. It's
right.
Yeah.
You see it in person, it's even worse. But I just think a lot of people have a tendency to step back from it, which is natural because...
See, there's no way, and this is interesting, what the caller is saying, there's no way for anybody who's not experienced this, and either as a soldier or somebody who's been involved as a correspondent or whatever, who's not experienced this, to really convey the horror of it. You cannot do that, because even when in the most graphic movies, for example, Saving Private Ryan, which that first 20 minutes of that film about landing on Utah and Omaha beaches, you get a real sense of what was happening. I mean, it was just horribly messy and gory. But you know what's missing there? It's the odor. It's the smell that you cannot ever convey to anybody who's never covered war or covered that kind of a situation. And so no matter how hard Hollywood tries, or television or anybody else, or even journalists when they're writing, you just can't convey that unless you've seen it yourself. And you, having been there as a soldier, you know what I'm talking about.
No, you've never – you really hit the – that's the correct word, because when you I've been around people that were killed. I'm sorry. Thank you very much. Bye.
Well,
how much Vietnam still is with us.
It has not gone away. I mean, it's still there.
No, and the memories of it linger and are so powerful.
Yes.
It's so very powerful for people. And what I think is so fascinating about this is that, yes, your students and my students think it's ancient history, but it shapes our lives on an almost daily basis in ways that students, you know, can hardly even imagine. I mean, how many times are we comparing the Iraq War with Vietnam? Just that alone. But I think the Vietnam experience has shaped so much of our lives. I mean, look at the last few presidential election races that turned on the fact, well, did you serve or didn't you serve?
Right.
You know, and if you didn't, there was an issue in one way or another.
You know, you interviewed the late David Halberstam in 1998 for this book, and I was interested to know what his views of the women correspondents were that he worked with in Vietnam.
Oh, he was very interesting, and I think that I forever cherish that time with David, because that was very early in my research. Some of the ways in which he talked about the women and talked about my project at that early time really validated what I was trying to do. He actually said, he said, I was thinking about this before you arrived, and he said, you know, the story of any woman who reported on the Vietnam War is first a story of how she got there. And that was such an insight, because, you see, in the very beginning, the women couldn't get the assignment for Vietnam, and so they just picked up and went themselves. He spoke with great respect about many of the correspondents. He didn't like some of them and you know, had different opinions of them. And being David Halberstam, he was never shy about voicing those opinions. But I think that he certainly believed that they added a dimension to the war, and he certainly had great respect for them. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea that he understood that getting there was half the battle, and that most of them had to undertake it on their own, and that probably held up until, oh my gosh, well, I mean, the first really serious breakthrough comes in 1970, when the New York Times sent Gloria Emerson to be a resident correspondent.
Right.
And the AP and the UPI were among the very latest organizations to send reporters. Now, they didn't mind hiring some of the women reporters who landed in Saigon, having paid their own way there and sort of paid their dues in doing freelance work for a time. But the real breakthrough, I think, comes in 1970. And of course, by the time Gloria Emerson leaves in 1972, although, you know, we're still there for 3 years, we have a diminishing role in the war. In fact, Gloria says when she gets there, well, you know, they thought the war was almost over, so, you know, they didn't mind sending a woman.
We have time for one more caller. You're on Focus 580 from Urbana. Is there a caller there? No? Okay. Well, I'll move on to the next little point here. I guess somebody's online. You know, you also interviewed Frances Fitzgerald, and you know, she tell us a bit about her and her contributions to the genre of women war correspondents in general and to understanding the war in Vietnam in particular, because she wrote a really seminal book about the war.
Yes, her book is Fire in the Lake. Mm-hmm. Actually, speaking of David Halberstam, he called her a cultural anthropologist working as a journalist. And I think that's really what she did in Vietnam. She had absolutely no interest in the battle, but she found a translator, and she went out back and back and back into the villages and came to understand the society in ways that I'm not sure anyone else ever did. And she came back to the States and worked with a French Vietnam scholar, Paul Mousse, and commuted to New Haven, to Yale, where he taught for more than a year to learn more about Vietnam, to enrich her understanding of that peasant society.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is so fascinating about Frankie, and she was another very gracious person in my research, but her father was the number three man in the CIA. Her father, in a sense, had provided the information on which the policymakers based their decisions. And he, as a veteran of World War II and the Cold War, certainly, you know, believed that you had to be there and fight communism, as did so many of the reporters very early on. But my chapter on Frankie begins at the moment when she's undertaking a journey to D.C. to visit with her father. She has the transcript of an article that's about to be appear in the Atlantic magazine, and she's going to show him. And this is the first time that she has so unequivocally said, this can't work.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, she chickens out. She didn't quite have the nerve to show him, and before it was ever published, he died. And she said to me once, well, maybe it's better that it never really happened.
Right.
Very interesting.
You know, this. I had so many things I wanted to go over with you about this book, and we only got through about a quarter of what I wanted to talk to you about. So we've got to do this again, perhaps, get you back and talk more about the book. How's the book doing, by the way? Have you been on some book tours? And
well, I've been, yeah, actually, I was in Chicago just a couple of weeks ago at the Pritzker Military Library. That was a lovely event.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been reviewed in some very nice places. I think the best one so far is American Journalism Review. Yeah, and it's gotten very nice reviews, and I'm very pleased. I'm very pleased with the way it's going.
Well, a 10-year project, I mean, that's a lot out of your life, you know.
Yes,
so.
It is. It really is. But I guess in many, many ways it was a labor of love. Although I have to say, I told this to a couple of the women, I was married 10 years ago. My work on this book really began in 97 on my first trip to Vietnam.
Mm.
And I don't think my husband realized that he was marrying all of these women at least for the first 10 years of our marriage.
That's a good point.
He's glad he only has one wife now.
Well, our guest today has been Joyce Hoffman, author of On Their Own, Women Journalists and the American Experience in Vietnam. Joyce, thanks once again for spending this time with us today. Our technical director has been Kyle Mayberry, and And that wraps things up for Focus 580. We hope you stay tuned for the afternoon magazine, which will be coming up next. Thank you very much.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates offers four area locations, including on the lower level of the Illini Union at the Oasis. WILL programs are made possible in part by Bevier Cafe 2, offering gourmet sandwiches, salads, and specialty coffees with seating inside or outside in the lower courtyard of the Institute for Genomic Biology next to Morrow Plots on the U of I campus.
Good morning. It's 3 minutes before noon. My name is Celeste Quinn, and I'll be your host this afternoon for the Afternoon Magazine. In the 1 o'clock hour of the program today, we'll talk about the Colorado Coalfield War of 1913-1914. It resulted in the deaths of at least 75 people. We'll take a look at this deadly Union management war with historian Thomas Andrews, author of the book Killing for Coal. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening in Chicago and Kansas City with the commodity markets. In Kansas City, December wheat is trading at $5.88. That's up 10. March, $6.02, up 9. In Chicago, December wheat, $5.51.5. That contract up 13.25. March, $5.66, up 7.25. December corn, $3.75.5, down 1.5. March, $3.92.5, down 1. May, $4.02, down 2.75. July, $4.15.5, down 1/2. November soybeans, $8.82, down 5. January, $8.87.5, down 6.5. March, $9 even, down 3. May, $9.05, down 8.25. December soybean meal, $265.50, up 1.50. December soybean oil, $32.28, down 53. At the Merck in Chicago, December live cattle, $90.60, up 5. February, $91.25, down 47.5. November feeder cattle, $96.85, down 32.5. January, $95.80, That down 57 and a half. And December lean hogs 55.75, down 45. Outside markets, December crude 56.40, down 184. The U.S. dollar 86.71, that's up 26. The CRB index 247.35, down 28. On Wall Street, the Dow is off 237 points at 85.99. The NASDAQ is off 54 at 15.43. The S&P 500 off 28 at 8.83. This is WYLL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: cloudy with areas of rain, highs ranging from 47 in far northwestern Illinois to 64 in the far south. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with